Okay, everybody, welcome to Topical Fever, episode 13. My name is David Parsons, and I thank you very much for joining me on the podcast. This week, I'm talking to Hillary Miller. Hillary is a teacher and a writer and a playwright, one of those very interesting, smart people that I was lucky enough to be introduced to in graduate school and continue to know but through my work at the Schwartz Institute at Baruch College. I was finally able to wrangle her for a conversation at the Schwartz Institute, and we talked about a lot of the really cool projects that she's involved with, one of which is called American MD. American MD is a web series produced in Brooklyn. Hillary is the writer and the producer of this series in collaboration with a lot of really cool people. And this project is like I said, a web series, a comedy that takes on the American healthcare system. So we talked a lot about what it's like to try to produce something, produce a piece of art, whether it be theater or a web series or even a podcast that kind of takes on social and political issues. And we kind of talked about it in light of, you know, the difference between doing that in a kind of comedic or fictional or narrative form as opposed to a documentary form, and what are the differences and challenges inherent in that. So we had a really great conversation, and I hope you enjoy this talk between me and Hillary Miller. So how did you get into theater and I don't say that as an educator. Mm-hmm. You're now like a very high intellectual about theater from the CUNY Graduate Center. But how did you? I mean, as a kid, I mean, where did your theater? Because I didn't get into theater and maybe I would have if other elements had been at play. But I got into movies really hard. So why was it theater for you?
I've thought about that a lot because theater is still sort of, you know, marginalized in a lot of ways within the humanities. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, you know, I would turn around, especially during the PhD, and I would say, like, where did this whole thing even start? And kind of more started with writing rather than theater.
Mm-hmm.
Because growing up, I was just really into poetry, and, you know, I had like all the journals and things, I did a zine,
You did a zine?
I did a zine growing up, yeah.
90s?
This would have been probably 94 that I did a zine.
And, prime 90s.
Actually, something very embarrassing just happened, which was that I donated like a huge box of zines, my own and ones that I had collected for years and years. I donated it to the Barnard Zine Library. And little did I know that they were going to like catalog it alongside the names of all of the people that can be found on those zines.
Wow.
And some of my good friends wrote to me and they were like, on a Google search, my zine now comes up.
That's so cool.
Because it's in the Columbia Library database system.
That's amazing.
Yeah, but if you had, you know, if you had created a zine when you were a 14-year-old female, you might not want it to be cataloged.
Yeah, no.
Google search.
Or if I think that my 14-year-old male self would have been pretty embarrassed by
the whole thing. There's no way around it. It's a little awkward.
My zine probably would have been a lot about like magic and David Copperfield. And like that's what I was into when I was 14.
That's really cool.
Like,
no, mine was my first one. I started right after junior high school, and it was called Egeria, which I read somewhere. I had one of those like tear off word a day calendars, and Egeria means something like it's something like a society of women. Like I know, really, you know, I put like Amelia Earhart on
that's
the cover.
That's so cool. It sounds like you knew who you were at an earlier age than I did, because like magic and cowboy hats. I mean, I tried on a lot of different like identities. I was like, there's this Onion article about like the college kid that has like he's a Rasta one week, and then the next week he's like,
the
hip hop kid.
Right,
like,
anything that can make me disappear.
Yeah. Maybe that's the suburbs that like strip you of any like coherent identity, and you have to find one from pop culture somewhere. But
you know, it's not totally off though, because I felt like I was hiding it for a lot of time. Like I made the zine, and I was kind of secretive about it, but I'd mail it back and forth.
Mail it?
Yeah, I was, you know, because I'd trade them. We'd do trades. That was the big thing with the scene.
It's crazy. It's like the internet. It's like we gave birth to the internet because we were doing this already. Does that make sense to you? Like, it's like we really, really wanted to connect so badly.
Yeah.
And like, especially like, I don't know. I don't, maybe counterculture is the wrong word, but there was this feeling that like, we got to make some other alternative kind of connection.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden the internet at the same time kind of emerges and becomes the kind of structure for that. And now we have Facebook. which is
I'm always curious to do more research to figure out, like, you know, what's the young zine girl making of the internet right now?
Yeah,
I'm sort of.
Yeah.
I'm not hooked in. I'm out of it. But so I was doing a lot of writing. I was doing zines. I was doing poetry. And then when I got mm-hmm. to high school, I went to high school at Edward R. Murrow, which is. Mm. Has such notable alums as Marissa Tomei,
mm-hmm.
and actually does have a great theater.
My wife
program.
Called it the hippie school. She said that everybody wanted to go to Edward R. Murrow because it was like and I don't mean hippie, but I mean, you know, alternative in some
yeah,
way, right?
They yes.
don't have. Is it one of those places where they don't give grades and things like that?
They gave they had letter grades, not number grades, which was interesting for here. But they were uh-huh. their own letter grades. Like the highest was an E for uh-huh. excellence. and when I visited for the first time. It's like this huge building with 4,000 students in it. Actually, when mm-hmm. I was there, it was 4,200. And I would just like walk through the halls with my mom the first time that I visited. And there were all of just these like shadowy figures like hanging out in the hall.
Yeah.
And it's basically that there, when you had your free periods, you could do anything that you wanted with them. People would just sit in the hallways and you'd cluster in certain areas depending on who you hung out with and what your group was. But within that, yeah, it was progressive in terms of how the school was mm-hmm. run and managed.
It's not an arts high school specifically.
No, yeah, no, you didn't have to. It's just a regular public high school. You didn't have to test to get in. So, you know, I worked on the school newspaper there. I mean, I worked on the literary magazine. I did mm-hmm. all sorts of, you know, creative type pursuits.
Yeah.
And it sounds like
even with the zine thing before Edward R. Murrow, you had a kind of like... Yeah. I need to get your voice out there or engage.
But what's interesting was that not as like an actor. Like a uh-huh. lot of people went there and they were like, here's my moment on the stage. And they like did the whole, right. you know, I want to be the lead in Pippin kind of a thing.
Uh-huh.
Which I did more of the, like in theater, I was always, like I took lighting class and stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't really do the on stage presentational stuff. I kind of shied away from that, even though it was hugely popular there. Everybody wanted to audition. Not everybody. Many, many people wanted to audition for shows. And also very cool were the crew people who would mm-hmm. work the shows. Mm-hmm. They'd like cut all their classes and smoke a lot of cigarettes and be on crew and hang out in the crew room. So I don't know. From the experience of high school, I just got opened up to a lot of theater from seeing it and from hanging out with those people, and then ended up starting to do playwriting again because I'd mm-hmm. been writing so much. And I got signed up by an English teacher for a free playwriting workshop mm-hmm. at Young Playwrights.
This is in high school?
Yeah, this was just in high school. So I was like starting to tinker around actually writing plays. So I got to college sort of knowing that I was interested in playwriting as mm-hmm. a form.
Yeah.
Even though I was also still really interested in poetry. But I think... Strangely enough, the scene for undergrad in terms of poetry was really not that interesting for me. The mm-hmm. academic poetry world didn't really grab me, and I think I saw it maybe I think maybe it was just too personal. It was too private. I didn't see it as something I wanted to really work on.
Mm. You've got more of a social engagement, it seems like. I'm not joking. I'm serious.
No, but I'm trying to trace,
you know, this. I don't know this your development and as a thinker and writer and everything else and what especially, you know, even Edward R. Murrow High School, right, has got
that's
this
true.
Like the Edward R. Murrow is you know the ultimate kind of symbol of liberal social civic engagement, you mm-hmm. know. But I was wondering what about your parents or your families or something, because I often locate that in people that they I talked to a filmmaker the other day, Robin Blotnick, about his film with Rachel Lears, and they're doing, they're both activists. And I asked him the same question. He said, oh, my parents met at a anti-nuclear plant rally in the 70s, and they had me basically while they were traveling around protesting nuclear plants. And I was like, okay, that actually, I can see a continuity.
Matches up.
Yeah. So what about your family?
Well, you know, it's funny because you read stories and a lot of writers come from writers, and so it just feels really natural. Like
right.
it would just be a natural thing to wake up and, you know, commit to the desk every day.
Yeah, the routine.
Which is, the routine of writing, which is something that I feel like has taken me a really long time to mm-hmm. learn and to square with, actually.
Yeah.
That it's only in the last few, maybe just 2 years, that I feel like I've really figured out a lot about the discipline and the practice mm-hmm. of writing as mm-hmm. a writer.
Yeah.
And part of that might be that my parents are really hard workers and they're both professionals, but they're not writers. So for a long time, I didn't necessarily see the connect in some ways between what I was interested in trying to do. But a lot of the connections for what I'm interested in and what I've pursued are very obvious. I mean, they met at Brooklyn College, actually, where my dad was, as the stories go, a bit of a student radical.
I've heard those stories. I've seen The Big Lebowski.
And they met, and my mom actually was in night school at the time, and they met at a class there, and I think they were both political science majors. They both had real interest in politics and American history, and that's where they met and ended up. Well, my dad has always been really engaged and involved in politics, and you know, when I was going to ask,
were there conversations at home about politics?
Yeah. Well, he's a big political memorabilia collector. So, I mean,
what does that mean?
You would like love their house.
What is political memorabilia? Like Nixon bobbleheads and stuff like that?
No. Buttons,
posters. Buttons and posters.
Historical posters from different presidential campaigns. All sorts of buttons. He has a whole series of collections of labor buttons, labor party buttons.
I love that stuff. I love that stuff. A guy that's that was one of the main sources for my dissertation is named Fred Gardner, and he's an activist from this era. And he has a garage in Alameda, which is near San Francisco. You'll know Alameda when you head up there. He has this garage that he showed, like, after we were done with our interview, he was like, "You want to come out to my garage and see my stuff?" I'm like, "Yeah, sure." It opens up his garage, and he's just got like this. It's like a museum, but I mean, it's not a museum. It's just his stuff.
Just what
and
he
it's
has.
Just like he had this poster that he designed. And it was a poster that he actually got the MTA to put on the New York City subway in like 1966 or 67. And it's a poster of like a burned Vietnamese child. Like it's just a picture of that. And it says, "Your tax money is paying for the murder of children in Vietnam."
In the MTA.
Yeah. And the MTA put that up. Like, it made me think of actually Ben's thing on the cacophony the other day about the obesity ads
yes.
in New York, and there's this weird public shaming going on with that, and it's like I thought about the weird public shaming about Vietnam shifting to now obesity and teenage pregnancy, which those ads are everywhere in Sunset Park, and they are so depressing. For those of you who aren't from New York, there are ads in New York City everywhere now that are from, I guess, Bloomberg's office, right? That are like kind of...
I think it is the Department of Health and whatever they call that in the city.
And they're kind of like focused on these particular social issues. And the ones they've chosen to attack right now are overeating of junk food and getting pregnant if you're a teenager. And the tone of them is just so awful. Particularly the pregnancy ads that I've seen a lot of are just like they chose really like crying, sad kids. The picture is a kid that you wouldn't want, and they say things like you know your man will leave you if you get pregnant, and things like that. I mean, they're really
what's really terrible about them too, not too long ago I did work helping to write a kind of infographic for a nonprofit that was creating an infographic trying to inform young people about prevention.
Right.
And the one rule that they had set for this infographic, which was designed for teens, was that there could be no negativity. Mm. And my first draft, I thought, was so positive and had no negativity. And they returned it to me, and like the head research people and educational outreach people said, too negative," pointing out every spot where if I had even said something like, you know, "I know things are really scary," you know, to try to relate.
Right,
it would be like,
no, that's
no.
too negative.
This is just the only time that we have to get them through this message. Why are you putting negativity in this little infographic? And that the studies that they've done have actually shown that this age group of teenagers will not respond to any negative messaging. They will
then
just shut down.
It sounds like the New York City
the
Health
campaign
Board
is just right on track.
Yeah,
right
going
on track.
In the right direction. Yeah. Oh
but
my
so
God,
yeah.
That's
so
insane.
So getting back to memorabilia, I think that it was around the politics were around me, interestingly enough, visually before I really got like, oh yeah, that's a series of commemorative plates for Kennedy. You know,
yeah,
I wasn't
totally
conscious and aware of it. And my mom being a little, you know, my dad being a lawyer and now a judge and also has actually ran for city council in Brooklyn. So always also very engaged on a more local level.
Your dad's not Anthony Weiner, is he?
That's hysterical.
Okay.
And my mom more, I mean, also equally, but interestingly enough, in a different way, that I think they're on two different poles that I've thought about a lot, you mm-hmm. know, what this means in terms of being engaged in the world. My mom is a social worker.
Mm-hmm.
And so for her...
It's very, yeah, that seems very, it seems very clear to me now.
Yeah. So, I mean, and she was a social worker most, you know, the bulk of her career was actually at CUNY.
I say that when it's very clear, but at the same time, I don't think there's always a continuity with people and their parents, because oftentimes, no. I mean, I don't come from activist parents or anything, but yeah, here I am. And at the same, on the same token, I have a lot of friends that had like total hippies for parents that became very conservative people. And the hippie thing.
That's interesting.
The hippie parents actually pushed them to the conservatism in a weird way.
Well, and don't you sometimes look at those friends and say, God, or maybe you're one of them. Maybe I would look at you and say this. You're kind of brave for totally breaking away from whatever influences.
No, you're right. But there's also an element of like, how much did you really break away? You know what I mean? I think that we often fool
ourselves.
You're
still in the matrix.
Yeah. And like, as far as you get from wherever you started, I think you're still there in a way. So, you know, the accent comes out when you're mad or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of can't escape that. So, all right, so you go to college. You kind of, it sounds like you, as an undergrad you majored in theater. Is that right?
I made well. This point, is funny. I wanted to be a women's studies major, and it was actually a conversation with my dad, and he said, "This is really not a good idea." Which I appreciate that now. Yeah. I understand it really clearly now why he said that.
Yeah. On the other hand, I would have loved to have been a women's studies major.
Well, I remember the conversation with him really well, and him thinking very strategically. And I think, of course, as most 18, 19, 20 year olds, I didn't have much strategic thought process happening.
He was like, wanted to know about the job at the end of the rainbow.
At the end of the rainbow, or even you know, that's a good question, exactly what aspect of it was, because he was fine with me being a theater major.
Right.
But
it's like theater is a step in one direction, but then when you take the step to women's studies, that's taking it. I mean, sorry, that's just taking it far, much too far. It's like, what are we doing here?
Too far. Yeah. But it says something about me that I don't know that I was. I think I was just gravitating whatever was interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I didn't really have the conviction to say this is exactly why I need to be a women's studies major.
Right.
I was just sort of vaguely saying those look like the classes that I would like to be sitting in.
And don't you have students now that kind of present the same situation to you now, and they don't know what to do? I mean, I have so many. I had a student come up to me and actually give me numbers and said, this is how much I think I can make if I go to dental school, and this is how much I think I can make if I go to law school. What major do you suggest I do? And it's insane. I mean, really, he wanted to know the difference between $99,000 a year and $103,000. And I was like, you're approaching it in the wrong way.
But maybe. What's interesting is
he
that...
I told him to go major in women's studies.
That's... I maybe could have... been somewhere in between him and where I was, you know, because I mean, I remember even at the time coming home on probably this is one reason why my dad was like concerned about my lack of strategic thinking. The lights went out in here.
Motion. We have to make a motion and the lights will come back on. Hold on. I'll stand up. Oh, there it is.
I do remember.
More motion than I thought, actually. All right.
Coming home one summer. I just was like, yeah, this summer I'm going to like be a waitress. It's just like I really wanted to work in a restaurant and get that experience.
Mm.
And I think that was great. But at the same time, I knew that I wanted to be in women's studies, I think, because of a more social engagement, social justice aspect. So, but I didn't, you know, like I look back now and I'm kind of like, yeah, I didn't quite know, like, well, what organizations do I want to, you know, like, what do I want to get in, you know? What do I actually want to do? I think it was really in some ways that I was just excited to be meeting people whose ideas excited me. And I thought, okay, women's studies.
Yeah.
And in the end, majoring in theater just made more sense because my dad had a good point. That it sort of also meant something ultimately for what I might want to do after, if it's grad school or this or that.
Right.
And the other thing was it allowed me to take a lot of classes in playwriting and other kinds of writing. But I did a modified.
So you got to write creatively while you were an undergrad.
Exactly.
I think that's really important, actually.
Oh, that was hugely important. My thesis was a play. My honors thesis, or I don't know if it's honors, but my senior thesis was a play.
Right.
And it was actually a play that ended up going to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival after college.
Uh-huh.
And that was one of the first sort of like felt like a real production experience.
It seems like so rare, but maybe it's not, to have an undergrad experience like that, that literally forms a bridge into the quote unquote real world, because mm-hmm. because the Fringe Festival is like a real thing, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's not just for college kids.
It's become so big. It feels like it's for everything.
It's a cultural landmark.
It is. Yeah. And it was a huge experience to go there. And it was also one of my first experiences really realizing that I had no idea what I was doing in terms of marketing, selling, or talking about my work.
Was that an element of it that you just put off, or that you didn't want to engage in? I mean, the reason I bring that up is because that's the business end mm-hmm. of it a little bit. That mm-hmm. I think when you're young, you're obviously kind of focused on the kind of creative end of mm-hmm. it, and that's what you want to do. And there's always that purity and that kind of like, well, I don't need to learn that part of it.
Mm-hmm.
But that part of it is kind of like 90% of it.
It is 90% of it. I wrote a journal article just this year about the issue of MFA programs mm-hmm. in playwriting that don't quite know how to do it in a logical, not invasive way. They err too much on one side or the other.
Right.
Like, well, we can't corrupt your voice, so we're not going to talk about like where your work actually will have an audience mm-hmm. or what that mm-hmm. audience might look like.
Right. Right.
Because it's a little bit too corrupt.
So it's like
pure art. Or it'll be on the other side of it, and you'll be sitting in a screenwriting class that's like, okay, you're on the couch.
Yes.
You know,
right.
How are you going to pitch this?
Oh,
and
God.
You know.
I mean, I having gone to film studies or majoring in film studies at UC Santa Barbara, which is close to Hollywood, there was this kind of weird split in the film studies department between, we called it production in theory, but it was like people that wanted to make movies and go to Hollywood and do that Dawson's Creek, Steven Spielberg kind of thing.
Everybody loves Raymond.
Right. And then the group of people that were more cynical, mm-hmm. cigarette smoking philosophers that just wanted to study film and talk about film theory and the kinds of things that we didn't like it, you know, Alison Griffith's class. And there was a lot of animosity between those two, but what's interesting is they need each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like
absolutely.
those guys that are like, I don't want to do the business stuff. I just want to make movies. The best cultural producers are the people that are able to balance those two elements. It seems like
it's true.
You have to.
It's absolutely
get
true.
Involved in the business. Unfortunately,
yeah. And you know, when I was at Edinburgh, I was very young, and it was so difficult to get people to come to the show because you're in competition with all of these things, and I had a very sort of formative experience where we had a reviewer just sort of kind of decimate the show in some ways mm-hmm. in this one newspaper. And then in another newspaper, give a pretty positive review, but it was much smaller. It was like this tiny little blurb.
Right,
you know, that was like very complimentary about, you know, this New York playwright who really captures this dysfunctional
family.
You must
have been young, though. How old were you when this happened?
I mean, this was, this was the summer after, the first summer after I'd graduated from college. So how old are you? I was like 22.
Yeah.
And we found out at one point that the same reviewer wrote both reviews.
Mm.
But they were for two different newspapers.
Wow.
And
that's interesting.
Yes, and I ended up speaking to him because they had a panel of reviewers at one of these things.
Right.
And it was basically my first lesson about audience.
Hmm.
He was like, I'm writing this one in the really big Fringe publication that everybody read. He just felt it wasn't going to be the kind of play that he wanted to steer like the Fringe masses to.
Right, right.
But then in this little blurb.
I had no idea.
This little tiny blurb in this, I think it was called The Guardian, this little blurb. He was complimentary because he felt that maybe, you know, that audience might take to it. But the one that kind of really mattered for what people were reading when they were actually at the Fringe buying tickets was not great. You know, mm-hmm. it didn't savage me, but it was just meh.
Yeah.
And that was a huge moment for me because I thought, that's so unfair.
Yeah, right.
But, you know.
Right. But it sounds like that would be a huge learning moment too, because you're like, okay, now I got to realize that I'm writing for different audiences in a sense. And then, I mean, there's a sense of like when you're an artist, I'm not writing for any audience, you know, I'm writing for myself. But I guess that's part of the same thing we were just talking about, which is kind of being pragmatic about, you do want people to listen to this.
It's true. But I think, man, maybe this is just how I respond to things and you can perhaps relate,
mm-hmm.
that it sort of shoved me in the opposite direction.
Mm.
You know, it was not long after that, actually, that I went to Naropa to do a summer program. I don't know if you know about their writing program.
I do know Naropa very well. Is that in Boulder, Colorado?
It's in Boulder, Colorado.
Yeah, yeah. This is Claudia is writing about Anne Waldman, who's a...
Who I took a class with when I was there.
Yeah, and Claudia's in the middle of writing her next project, a biography of Anne Waldman. And so the Naropa Institute is a place where we will eventually travel for this book research. But
it's a fantastic
place.
Yeah,
that whole world is amazing.
The whole world is amazing. It's rife with contradictions and really, really interesting. I mean, I would read your wife's book in a second.
Yeah, she's writing about this thing called the Naropa Poetry Wars of the 1970s that I don't know if you've heard about.
I've heard about them. You know, when you go there, the great thing about going there is that it's a place that is just stuffed with its own history.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's still people there telling stories about the original guy who came, and you know, it's really full of its own kind of legacies and history. And there's something really beautiful about that.
Yeah,
and it was exactly what I wanted in terms of
New Yorkers there too. It's like this weird kind of connection to like the beat New York scene.
It was like a strange outpost.
Anne Waldman's one, but Allen Ginsberg was there too. And
it was a really wild outpost. Mm-hmm, you know, people would sort of run away to there, and some would stay, and others would come back. And you know, I would go into a bookstore there, and it's like these books on, you know, it's Jack Kerouac's Dharma poetry and writing and engagement. And I sort of thought, well, that's a much better area for me to pursue than standing in the middle of this very commercialized Edinburgh Fringe Festival where I'm like begging these tourists to take a postcard about this play that I'm so earnest about. You know, I think in a way it was so bruising that I sort of thought, well, let me go take a step back in terms of my writing.
I'm glad you brought that up. I mean, I can definitely relate because that I feel like it was reading the beats specifically. I mean, you mentioned like Kerouac and stuff like that. It was the beats that kind of brought like an authenticity. It made me want to feel that authenticity. And then reading more biographies about the beats, I'm like, wait, these guys weren't that authentic. But at the same time, like I feel like the beats that were an entry into that same kind of idea for me, which was that I don't know that there is a need to get away from feeling like you need to satisfy anyone because otherwise you're not going to get to it. You know what I mean? Like in order to write good art, I feel like you have to produce good art. You have to get into yourself in a way that's I don't know, it's mystical in a sense to me. It's like you have to really like touch the core of something human that's very, very far from any kind of thought about pleasing a market or anything like that. And so in a sense, all that, I mean, it's a kind of a cliche, but all that market stuff gets in the way in some ways. That's what's so hard about balancing maybe producing something getting it made.
It's very true. And the beautiful part about Naropa is that they were there ready to talk about all of that.
Yeah.
You know, this is where you go to get in touch with whatever it might be that's telling you that writing is sort of like your primary muse. It's what you are faithful to. And then, you find out a few weeks later, like, oh, yeah, how does Naropa pay the bills and how do they live?
Yes,
you know, and
right,
then you start getting into the materiality of what these different experiences are.
Well, I mean, speaking of material, you're in theater, so you're doing, you know, when you write something, it's not done on the page. You're not writing a novel. You know, you're writing something that you want to be actually produced. You want actors to say the words, and you want people in an audience to watch it. And with film, it's even, you even have like this element of, so it takes so much goddamn money to make a movie that I don't know if you saw that Steven Soderbergh just like retired from film.
I read a bit about that.
I didn't read his rant yet. He wrote this like long thing about the film industry, but I've read stuff like that before from him, and what he's ended up on is painting. And I feel like a lot of like older artists, whatever they may be, end up like, it's painting. I just got to paint. I just got to like take that, what I was talking about, like the core of inside me and just splatter it onto a canvas. And that's what my art is now, because there's too many like barriers between me expressing what I want to express. Like I want to make this movie, but I'm gonna have to get in touch with construction unions, and I'm gonna have to do like every kind of, and you know this, and maybe this is good because we can get to American MD, because I want to talk about that the most. But the idea that of producing something with cameras and equipment and actors and everything else is just an insane amount of elements that have to come together. Sometimes I marvel at how anything ever gets produced. I mean, I guess we talked about this in film a lot, which is kind of like, we talked about it in a very like kind of theoretical way. Like, where is the author in something like this? Maybe it's less so with plays because there's less, but maybe not, because there's less of a kind of like cameras and sound.
Yeah.
But there's still like an incredible amount of production that has to come together.
Yeah.
And I mean, do you ever, you've had plays produced, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
Do you ever sit there? Do you feel like what's on the page and what you see are very far apart? Or is it something that often you're just like, this is exactly what I mean, imagine.
I think I've worked with really good directors, so the few actual real put-up productions that I've had, I have felt good about, except for, you know, there was one experience where I thought, yeah, the key is the collaborators,
yeah,
and that's
right.
Why everybody says that it's such a collaborative art. Well, and the same thing for film. You sort of realize that you can just be completely betrayed by the people that you're working with,
right.
And that they can not even mean to, mm-hmm. but that if you are not on the same collaborative plane mm-hmm. as they are, it can end up feeling, you know, you don't want to feel like you're just sort of putting on little rinky-dink puppet shows to amuse yourself.
Right,
and
right.
I think when things don't reach a certain level, there's a lot of expenditure of energy that doesn't uh-huh. feel like it reached what you were hoping for.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's the whole pursuit of the thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the entire... So it's hard to say that things have or haven't matched up. I think a lot of things about what you just said in terms of this question of things being so expensive and then saying, I just have to get a little more direct connection to what it is that I'm trying to make.
Yeah, right.
Because one impulse for actually working with American MD and creating a web series at all is because, you know, right now in New York, putting up a production, if you want to self-produce something, is actually ridiculously expensive.
Mm, and an independent mm-hmm. television or film production is difficult
York? For me, theater.
Ah.
That I actually looked to a web series because I was interested in experimenting with that narrative form. And mm-hmm. I was collaborating with two people who were interested in trying to, you know, follow through on this one idea about the Affordable Care Act and a web series.
So let me just introduce this. Hillary is involved in making, you're writing and producing it.
Yes.
And involved with a few other people
mm-hmm.
in Ditmas Park, Brooklyn.
Yes.
Is that primarily where you're shooting?
We were filming it mostly, yeah, there. But that was a matter of convenience because of some of the locations that we were managed to find.
So this is a locally produced web series
yes.
Called American MD, which you can find on AmericanMD.org. Is that right?
That is
yeah,
correct.
I think so. I have it up.
Unless it's dot, no, I think it is org.
It's American MD. I was actually impressed by the AmericanMD.org. That's right. And the series is a web series that's kind of a comedy that looks at healthcare.
Yes.
And looks at I love the tagline, "A Life Without a Plan," because it's so perfect. And it's a show that has three episodes up right so
mm-hmm.
far.
Yeah.
And is really when I saw it, I thought that's exactly what I'm into. And when I say that, I was like, I'm not into healthcare web series. I mean, I am, but mm-hmm. I mean. The idea of like a synergy between a social kind of consciousness,
mm-hmm.
and you're actually—I mean, this is a political show, and yet it's not like it's not a documentary.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a Michael Moore expose on the healthcare system that I watch and then feel helpless afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of something that's couched in something narrative. And I love that. And can you talk about the genesis of this show a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. Uh-huh. I mean, it's great to talk about it because I'm at the point in the process where we're thinking about where we want to go with it next.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And where we've been with it is that, well, as I was saying, I mean, I was doing a lot of theater and I felt that I just wanted to work on something.
Yeah.
And right now, if you want to rent out a theater in New York, you're probably going to be paying like $4,000 a week, $5,000 a week.
Are you kidding me?
No, really. Even for like a small Lower East
Side. You better
side
sell a
theater.
Lot of tickets.
Yeah. So
that's insane.
So, you know, for me, I was thinking, you know, I can hook up with theaters, but I'm already kind of sending my plays. Like everything was for me getting to a point of feeling like what we were just talking about before. I wanted to just get some people together that I like collaborating with and see this thing through.
Yeah.
And it began actually in a process where I was workshopping a play and with a bunch of actors, and somebody made a joke that we should call what we were working on Actors Without Doctors. And I thought it wasn't right for what we were doing.
Yeah, yeah.
But it seemed like a great title of a web series
right.
about actors who had no health insurance because
uh-huh.
I was in a room with a group of actors who were completely the opposite of what the stereotype is, which is that, you know, they just kind of like go to the gym and go to auditions. You know, these were people who were, many of them were working full-time jobs with, you know, and none, all of them were stressed out and freaked out about not having health insurance.
There, you mean the freelancers union was not helping them out?
Yeah, and they each had complicated stories about why the freelancers union did or did not work for them, whether their actors union, health insurance, you know, and it was so complicated that, and the younger ones that were just graduating college had so many questions about it, and it was really fraught, and they had a heavy relationship too with health insurance within their own families. Mental health issues came up. I mean, it became really, really clear that everybody was kind of like crackling about this issue. And so it was after that that my co-producer Tracy Hassis was sort of saying, why don't we do a web series, because we've been thinking that we'd like to experiment with this anyway. And I haven't really worked very much in film. I mean, I've written.
That's what I was thinking. Is that you're sitting here being like, "Oh, I'm not going to do," or "I'm going to," you know, theater's becoming difficult because it's so expensive. So I'll produce a TV show.
No, but the thing is, I had really like, I had burnt myself out. The last theater I had produced, I produced a production of T.S. Eliot's Murder in the Cathedral at a church in Prospect Heights.
That's so cool.
And it was a collaboration with the Catholic Diocese of Brooklyn, and it was a huge project that consumed really a full year of my life, and it was me only in the producer's seat, which, you know, was enjoyable, and in the end it was, I think, judged a success from many different perspectives, which was exciting, but it kind of made me step back and say, like, what do I want to really realize, what do I want to make happen? So I think I was in a unique place in terms of making a decision about what I wanted to do next.
And it sounds like the healthcare aspect of it and like the kind of socio-political aspect of it was attractive to you too.
It was very attractive to me, because I was coming from a place that you're probably also in, where I sort of thought, you know, I'm not a documentary filmmaker. I could imagine a very compelling documentary about this.
Yeah. But Michael Moore made Sitka already, though.
Yeah. You know? And aren't I more curious about whether there's a kind of an interesting narrative in this?
You know, whether
I can really shape something, because that's what was compelling to me about doing a web series is that I could actually create something episodic, which I had never done before.
Yeah. And I mean, to tell the truth, I mean, honestly, the most compelling parts of the health documentaries are the ones that look at one person's narrative.
One person, right? Exactly.
And so it's like jumping into that, I think is a really great way to kind of
and saying where are they going next.
And it should also be said, I mean, I don't want to go get insanely political here, but it should be said that the conversation that we're having in the mainstream media about health and in the last few years has been with this Obamacare word. And the conversation is not really focused on health. It's like focused on like whether or not people are going to get insurance.
Yes.
And the web series that you're making or that you've made and that you're continuing to make, American MD, is kind of more looking at look at how this system affects people on the ground. Because it's what I like about the series is that the characters in it, they just kind of take for granted that they have to do a lot of weird stuff to be able to navigate this world, and it reminds me of people that I know, and that getting healthcare, navigating healthcare, getting their prescriptions, etc., consumes their lives. I mean, really, and it's economic. I mean, it's not. It doesn't even have to do with health in a weird way.
Yeah,
it's like I was just talking to Suzanne, who's one of our bosses here at the Schwartz Institute, and we were talking about there's a new timesheet kind of procedure that we had to learn here at CUNY. And CUNY, I think, is famous for its bureaucracy. I mean, it's famous for its filling everything out in quadruplicate, etc. But what I was telling Suzanne, what we kind of came to, depressingly maybe, is that navigating bureaucracy is kind of the name of the game in a weird way, that like the people that succeed in life are the people that are able to attain a Zen attitude towards the insane amount of paperwork that you have to navigate to get things. And you will get things eventually if you fill it out right, maybe. But the healthcare system seems like it's that way.
And that's one of the challenges, too, of making the series, was that, you know, it's how do you dramatize in an interesting way those challenges? Because it can be very boring. It can sound interesting, but look very boring to have a person just kind of moving from false start to false start to false start.
Right.
And something that we're thinking about for future episodes is making it a little, well, I mean, I should say also that we had a really, we were really jazzed on the idea of having it done before the election.
Right, right.
because we had started to conceive it, I guess it was like last spring.
Uh-huh.
And we were interested in it for the same reasons that you're saying, that if we are showing more the health issues of a person, we don't even need to get up to the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah,
we can
right.
just show everything before that.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, exactly.
And that's where we were at, and we were really jazzed on that. And then, as anyone could have predicted, it was so much more of a heavy lift
yes.
to actually get even just the first pilot
that's
off
what
the
I
ground.
Wanted to ask you is how much was the production
it was
harrowing?
Just gigantically harrowing.
Yeah,
because, you know, even with three people working on a producing end of it,
mm-hmm.
if you're trying to at the same time fundraise as doing all of the logistical stuff,
yeah.
you're always going to be in a tailspin.
Yeah.
As opposed to saying, okay, we've got this money in the bank. And, you know, there's a lot of stuff that's complicated that's not necessarily interesting on a podcast about, you know, do you become a nonprofit when you're doing a project like this? Do you not become a nonprofit? I mean, there are a lot of decisions
yeah,
along
you know,
the
I just
way.
Listened to Louis C.K. talking mm-hmm. about, because he like makes his own show himself mm. and he's talking about like, I mean, he's talking about how I learned how to fill out union contracts. I learned mm-hmm. how to do all this, like, really, and that's what I'm talking about, navigating mm-hmm. bureaucracy
yes.
for making the movie even mm-hmm. is just finding out. And you're saying that did you encounter difficulties with the city of New York in filming? Or
that's an interesting question. I mean,
did you have to get permits, or did you do this guerrilla style?
You know, we did much of it guerrilla style when we probably should have gotten permits for some of the outdoor stuff that we did on the street.
Right.
That's for sure. One of the major costs of the entire production was just paying for the insurance that we were required to get for the days mm-hmm. that we would be filming, as well as the spaces that we were operating in.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the kind of thing that, you know, you say, oh, why are there all these web series on YouTube that are just in people's bedrooms?
Yes, yeah, that's why.
That's why.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the show looks, and I urge everyone who's listening to go to AmericanMD.org and check it out, because the show looks really great. Like, I was really impressed by
really?
It. It looks like it looks like a movie to me. And I wanted to ask you, there's obviously got to be experience here with cameras. There's not, these aren't people that just picked up a camera yesterday, right?
You know, we had a great, our director of photography, especially from the second episode. I mean, we worked with great people the whole way through.
How'd you find them? Are they all CUNY Graduate Center people?
They are
put
not.
Up signs
they
on
are
telephone
not.
Poles?
I should have used more CUNY Graduate Center people.
Why wasn't I asked to be involved in this? No.
There's still more episodes.
I know
you
there
can
are.
Still jump on.
I want to know maybe how you can. Maybe they can be like a podcaster character.
Well, what's funny? We did work with a couple of Baruch students as social media interns,
mm-hmm.
which they. They were corporate communication students.
Cool.
you know,
put them to work on American MD.
Well, and again, that was a really funny process too, because I think that they had the misperception from the beginning that was like, well, we've got this, you know, they said to us, oh, this show's really funny.
Uh-huh.
I was like, great, thanks. You know, that's great that you guys think it's funny. And then, oh yeah, 2-3 weeks later, how do we get more Twitter followers?
Yeah,
and it's like, yeah, social media
yes.
is
I've
enormously
yeah,
challenging.
I've learned that too.
They're all, you know, we would have all these long conversations about branding and all of that.
Uh-huh.
And I think
yep.
that I think that I was prepared to do that kind of work because, you know, when I was producing the show in the church, for example, a huge percentage of my time was taken up working with the Actors Equity, which is the mm-hmm. union contracts, and just making sure
and you
we
know
were
this
regulations
stuff now.
And
I mean,
and
I think you kind
of
expect
that.
It, right?
But then, interestingly enough, switching to a web series, then you're saying, okay, it's a totally different union, and
right.
we also not out. In addition to that, there is a lot that there's a process of self-education that everyone has to go through if they're producing a project that
mm-hmm.
is different from what they've done before,
right?
But the great thing about this web series is that we worked with such talented actors
yeah.
that at least the pilot,
I noticed that. Honestly,
yeah, the pilot
really
itself
good.
Actually just really felt great the first day that we went in. We had a reading of the pilot.
Uh-huh.
For me personally, now when I see the pilot, I think, oh yeah, the pacing is too much like a play.
Uh-huh.
It should, you know, I think I'm learning a lot about
yeah.
how I'm translating my own writing.
And you're all, and you'll also,
I
mean, I'm sure you know this and recognize this, is that when you work this hard on something and you produce something and you're editing it and looking at it again and
mm-hmm.
again, and again, you can't possibly have a distance from it. You see
not
all the mistakes.
Remotely. Exactly.
I mean, I guarantee I will listen to this podcast later and cringe at everything
yeah.
I'm saying, even what I'm saying right now. And then the way I said it, oh, I should have said this or I should have said that. But for the people that have never heard it or never, I mean, it's a totally different experience.
Oh, yeah. And every friend that I have a few friends who have produced their own projects that they've acted in, and mm-hmm. it is the most difficult part to not only have split brain around all of these different kinds of thinking that you have to be doing at any one time, mm-hmm. but then have the consciousness that actors have to have of how they're being looked at and how they're being perceived. And that in and of itself is its own talent. So, you know, part of what was really exciting about it was having other people be excited about it. That's the best part of any project where you feel like you're on a good path.
Uh-huh.
So that's where we ended up with it. And our editor was fantastic. We worked with a great editor. And really, at the end of the day, we felt like, okay, now we've got this great crew that we really like working with. We've mm-hmm. got three episodes.
Yep.
Did a couple of crowdsourcing, kind of fundraising things that were successful, some not successful. And now we're sort of saying, where do we want to take this for the next? We have three episodes that we're planning to film this spring.
Cool. That's awesome.
It is awesome. And, you know, I had a couple of friends, actually. I ran into one of my friends from childhood. I ran into him in Dimmis Park, and he said, you're kind of making propaganda.
Well, I mean, isn't that what you're doing a little bit?
I mean, when that word popped out.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. And it's weird because, but in a weird way, that's what we're talking about. It's kind of like couching a political attitude in, mm-hmm. within a narrative. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're basically Leni Riefenstahl. So congratulations. The Leni Riefenstahl of American
But what's interesting
system.
Is that her films would have to be a lot shorter now, because the one thing that everybody tells me that, you know, everyone's learning about these, about the web series format is that if you can't watch it in 4 minutes on your lunch break.
Yeah, our attention spans are getting shorter and shorter and shorter.
There's,
I mean,
like,
I sat and watched
rule.
I sat and watched these things, and they're like 12, they're like 12 or 13 minutes long.
Yeah.
And I guess I've been trained, and I come from a different generation. And even though
you're in the generation of the 4-hour film class.
Yeah, right. And it's like, let's sit down and watch Tarkovsky mm-hmm. for 4 hours, and it'll just be a lot of, like, just shots of dripping fountains and things like that. It's weird because there's this thing called Vine now, this application called Vine on Twitter that allows you to post very quick and easy 6 second. It's only 6 seconds. So it's like, it's weird because it's like this weird dictation you get, or a direction you get from the social media company like Twitter that says, like, 140 characters, that's mm-hmm. how we're going to express ourselves from now on, 140 characters. And now Twitter with Vine is saying, 6 seconds, you got 6 seconds. So is there any way you can make the American MD program 6 seconds?
6 seconds.
Yeah. It would seem like it would be a lot easier.
I did think about it.
It would cut costs a lot.
It would cut costs, and I did think a lot about...
And it's probably like you've shot like 50 episodes at least already, hundreds of episodes.
If they're only 6 seconds. But isn't that so scary how we, like, there aren't really rules for things.
Yeah.
But the rules become sort of codified and in place so fast
the
internet stuff that it is just, not only now are we expecting the form to look and be and seem like a certain thing.
Right, right.
But in fact, it has to be.
Yeah, like they said, they're telling, listen, sweetheart, your little YouTube series ain't going to work unless it's 2 minutes. That's how I feel when I hear that. But it's like, Vine, 6 seconds seems like, it reminds me actually, it's not unique to the internet in terms of like film. I think about it a lot with film because it's like, we learned this in Griffith's class, right? Yeah. In the history of film, it's like, when film was invented, no one knew what it was. But now we know it's an hour and a half to 2 hours. It has three acts, you know, the credits are at the end. There's mm-hmm. some music. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it really, there's like five things you need to make it a movie, or else it's not a movie. If you go up to someone and say, this is 6 hours long, that's not a movie. Mm-hmm. I mean, Andy Warhol's Empire State Building, 8 hours of the Empire State Building, is not a movie. Mm-hmm. People don't call it that. They're like, it's something else. It's art. And that's really, really interesting. It's like, well, will we eventually get to a point where the YouTube video, the mm-hmm. 6 second video, that's what a video is. Mm-hmm. And you doing this web series thing is something far beyond.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It makes me a little uncomfortable. But are you going to make it shorter? Are you going to make them shorter?
Well, that's what we're thinking about.
Yeah. Make them like little pithy.
I'm attracted to that too, because I like the idea of, I think if what we're trying to really get across is what you just described before,
uh-huh.
where it's just this person who's become totally accustomed to having to do these absurd things
right,
in order
right.
to get some measure of security
yes.
in her own healthcare.
Uh-huh.
Actually, the short form is something that I'd be excited about. And short, you know, within
like,
what I think of
yeah.
as 3 minutes, 4 minutes, 5 minutes. I think the 11-minute was this idea that, you know, people would get so attached to what was going on to that with that character that it would be that she'd be sort of our navigation tool through figuring it out, and you know, oh, we'd find out at the end what was actually wrong with her. And what's exciting about the fact that I'm changing it is that I am curious to say, well, but what if it's not all about, oh yeah, this end prize of what happens to her at the end, where I was thinking so much about what how the plotting leads to that end point, but rather within it.
You were applying a playwright kind of model to it, right?
I mean, you wanted a
total narrative, where it's like, it sounds like the web series, you want to just hit them with short bursts of narrative rather than a big arc.
Well, I mean, do you watch any of them? Have you watched any other web? Not American Mentor, but other web series?
I'm trying to think. I don't think I've seen a whole lot of web series.
It's pretty wild to
I guess I've watched. I don't know, different interview shows and things like that. A little quick.
You should check some out, because it is.
Are there other people doing social justice web series like that? So there have to be.
We did a lot of research, and there are people doing. It's not social justice, but taking on issues.
Yeah.
There was one that we found that I thought was a great idea, but they didn't have many episodes. There was one that was about a school board.
Uh-huh.
I thought that was, you know, that seemed to be its own kind of comment on bureaucracy. But I think it was trying to take more of, like, an approach like Parks and Rec or The Office or something. Yeah. It wasn't really yet hitting topics in education.
That's the thing. So there's this weird kind of, like, I don't know, people often make these things because they want to get seen. You know what I mean?
Like That's a huge piece of it.
You know, I'll produce something short. I mean, obviously that's how people work on YouTube now, but it's still the same system in a sense. It's like, I want to produce, like let's say I wanted to do something with comedy. So I'll do like a comedy routine on YouTube and get some followers, and hopefully NBC will eventually see me and give me an audition on Saturday Night Live. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, that's not really the democratic dream of the internet that I've had, right? It's like, it wasn't that it just gave us another access to more access to audition for giant companies. It should be we should be making stuff also alongside the giant companies and competing with them. I don't know how we do that, but
you know, there's one that you should look up that you'd be curious about. That's gentrification themes.
Oh, cool!
That I found that is, and I can't remember the name, but you'd be able to find it. It's set in. Not Harlem. I'm trying to think of where it's New York, though? Yeah. No, it's New York based. I think set uptown, upper Manhattan, and is basically kind of pulls out all these sort of neighborhood characters and is trying to confront these different issues in gentrification, but within a comedy, within a web series comedy.
Yeah.
And it seemed like it was really well done, but when I first was looking at it, it was fairly early on in the run. But that was something that I think that's a great idea for a web series, is trying to hit the gentrification issue.
What's it called? Do you know?
No, but I will think, maybe you should like find the name and say it at the very end of the podcast.
This is a great podcast. It's one of the more popular podcasts called Yo, Is This Racist? And it's literally just like talking about what's racist and what's not, and it's brilliant stuff. You know, I'm thinking about one of the big figures, and we're talking mainstream media, that does like narratives that have a kind of social edge to them, or political edges, David Simon, right? He makes made The Wire, and he's got a show on about New Orleans, post-Katrina New Orleans, called Tremé. And I bring it up because it actually reminded me, the plot line on Tremé about, I forget the character's name, but she's a, she owns a restaurant, and she,
I've only seen a few episodes.
When I was watching American MD, it reminded me of Tremé. It reminded me of that particular plot line of Tremé, of like being in the restaurant, and it's like a working class kind of restaurant in a working class neighborhood, and all the kinds of, I don't know, the things that come up when you own a restaurant and you're trying to be an independent kind of producer. It reminded me of the, when I was watching American MD, it reminded me of Tremé.
It's a big compliment. Thank you.
Well, I mean, I really like that whole idea of not being like necessarily the school marmish documentary. I mean, I guess I was kind of politicized by those documentaries in the same way that many people were. I talked about on the last show watching Michael Moore's Roger and Me in high school. Like, taught me what liberalism was and like what corporate, and I had never had that education before. And obviously, you know, as I get older, it gets more complicated, and Michael Moore's movies seem very simplistic to me now. But at the same time, they served a really important purpose. But they also gave birth to, especially during the 8 years of Bush, it seems like there was a whole like industry of these lefty documentaries, and they just got like it's almost like a factory the way they're produced. It's always producing the same kind of affect. It's always like this kind of weird, sympathetic kind of thing. And I always was like, why aren't there movies about this? Mm-hmm. Why can't we make this? Why does this have to be so grim?
Yeah.
You know, why can't this?
Yeah. And then you read that the right is already doing it. They've made movies about, you know, that are these anti-abortion films that show a woman making these difficult choices.
Yeah.
But that, you know, and I mean, and
Maggie Gyllenhaal just started an anti-union, in an anti-teachers
in
union
the film,
movie, right?
And yes, absolutely. Yeah. About the teachers union. I mean, I think that, well, I mean, it's funny that you bring up the woman in Treme, because, you know, that's such a place-based series.
Yes.
And one of the sort of more interesting conversations that I had after I showed one of my friends American MD is he basically said, you know, this is not American MD. That is crazy. If anything, it's Brooklyn MD.
Uh-huh.
And,
yeah,
and
right.
You have tried to sort of neutralize the location, which is something that we tried to do. We intentionally said
to make Ditmas Park be everywhere in
America. We said this is intentionally Main Street USA.
Yeah.
And one of my friends definitely called me on it in a way where he just sort of said, I think he felt that he was maybe exposing the fact that I had no perspective on how that this is like absolutely not mainstream.
Yeah, nice show, but you got it all wrong.
But it did make me think, because I had so been resisting that in part because of what you and I were talking about even before the podcast started, which is that I didn't want to do some like Brooklyn branding.
Yes.
You know, this is what this is about.
Yeah,
you know, this
right.
is just
no,
like
I
a
understand.
Woman in Brooklyn trying to run a restaurant.
Yeah.
Like, what can I say?
Goddamn hipsters.
You know, this is what this is about.
Mm-hmm.
I was kind of not really wanting to do that, even though there are a ton of web series out there that, kind of trade in the Brooklyn landscape thing.
My web series takes place in Brooklyn. Yeah, I get it. I understand that.
You know, I've thought
that's really interesting to me, considering that you're from Brooklyn. You're from this neighborhood.
Well, I think that's why it was fascinating to him. He was like, "Why are you resisting? Why are you completely like you're literally just washing out things that you know?"
What do you think about that? Are you taking that criticism? Are you going to make it Brooklyn MD in the next
Brooklyn MD
series?
I'm taking it seriously because I think it is interesting that in my academic writing and in when I write nonfiction, I'm very interested in urban issues, and I'm interested in Brooklyn. I'm interested in New York, and I write about these things.
Yep, yep.
And yet when I was making American MD, I was so attached to this non-place idea. It has to be America.
That's really interesting.
And
to
I
me.
Think that if somebody
in
else were
hating Brooklyn,
if somebody else were telling me that story, I would sort of say no piece of writing is going to be as successful as it could be if it were more specific.
Yeah,
it should be
right.
more specific.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Just go in that direction.
Yeah.
But I also kind of like the idea of saying, you know what, we don't need to overinvest in.
Uh-huh.
I think that there is so much for my money, there's just so much overinvestment in the kind of like icons of Brooklyn right now that end up being kind of meaningless. And I didn't want to, you know, there's so much to think about when you're trying to get it right. Like, I would have just driven myself crazy.
Yeah. No, I totally
trying
understand.
To get that experience right, because, you know, it's different from when you have the agency to be able to write a play where you feel like you can really get it how you want it.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been thinking, you know, I think about that a lot as we go into making the next three episodes.
Yeah.
You know, because I think that he saw certain signs in there that suggested to him that the main character was very much not representative of the majority of America.
Right. Well, that's what I liked about the show, is that the show has like women in it, and African-American women, and like people that like they never see women in America anymore. Where are they all? But you know what I mean. I mean, the show actually paid attention to that, and I appreciated that.
Yeah.
That it wasn't just a bunch of white guys running around, you know, talking about their problems, but it was people that don't often get a lot of, I mean, I guess I'm talking about types of women too, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that was really refreshing about the show. And I knew you would pay attention to that element, because that's
absolutely. Yeah, no, we did. We did. And it made me realize too, like, it's hard to cast anything. It's hard to cast any show, any play, anything.
Right.
And then it's hard to cast things when you're trying to achieve the look that we were trying to achieve, which was completely cross-sectional.
Yeah, and I mean, there is a scene on the show with, there is a white guy in your show, the guy with the beard that's like, that leaves
the
restaurant.
Yeah.
And it's a scene that felt like Treme, and that's what I'm talking about. He quits this job and is basically like, sorry, I have to go take this other job because I have to take the health insurance. And I know that is, there goes the lights again. That's something that everybody deals with, right?
Yeah.
So, there we are. That's something that I think everybody has heard.
Yeah.
that or done that exact thing. Like, mm-hmm. I have to take this job because of the health insurance. Mm-hmm. I mean, and that's not something that I've just heard from really, really poor people that mm-hmm. I know. You know, I mean, I've heard that from middle class people that are like, I have to take this job because yeah. I need the health insurance. Yeah. And so it leads to a kind of like, I don't know, people doing things that they don't necessarily want to do just to mm-hmm. just to obtain this kind of thing that's not even care. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not health care. It's just an insurance mm-hmm. card. I mean, it's a really, really, it's those kinds of things that make me feel like, feel the weight of the dystopia in a sense, like how Kafkaesque that is, that I need to get the job that gives me the card. Because if I have the card, then maybe I can get health care. Mm-hmm. Like, that's just, mm-hmm. And I'm so glad that you're doing something that kind of talks about that, because it's a weird, weird
It's so weird, world and, to be and in. It's so abstract that at times I think we would have to remind ourselves, you know, mm-hmm. what are we would have to, you know, I had a couple of articles that we had collected that were basically just like almost like archives of the bizarre stuff, you know, like yeah. people like breaking their arm and setting it themselves yeah. and just
it reminds it's like you it's know. Like people I mean it reminds me of like guys shooting themselves in the foot in Vietnam to go home yeah. it's like stuff that's so like I don't know so backwards and puts and always seems to locate the suffering and the people mm-hmm. that are the most vulnerable and that's mm-hmm. what's so I guess upsetting about it all and also what's cool about the making a comedy about something like that, mm-hmm. you know, that like it might the impulse might not be to make a comedy. Yeah. It might be just, well, we need to make this very, very serious. And this mm-hmm. is a very serious. But I really do think people respond to information when it's packed into comedy. I'm a big stand up comic fan. So I feel like some of the best political information I've got has been delivered by people like George Carlin or Chris Rock and things like mm-hmm. that like you could actually teach these little sections of like this is what gentrification is yeah. right this is like this guy's routine on it mm-hmm. So American MD is a really great example of that. I feel like I'm really happy
thank you
that you're doing this and it sounds like you've had some success, like you're gonna do it again yeah. and when I say success it sounds at least you feel like it's been a good experience. A learning experience?
It's been a learning experience.
Yeah.
It's been a real learning experience. I think it's been a good experience in how much it made me think about what I wanted to spend my time on in terms of writing and mm-hmm. The same thing that every project brings out.
Yeah.
You know, what did I think in the beginning versus what do I think now?
Right.
You know, it was extremely rich for that. I love feeling finally like I had the opportunity and the reason to sort of jump onto the web with my writing.
Yeah.
Because that
yeah.
was something that...
It seems like there's more of an immediate...
Yeah, there's something about it that, yeah. that's exciting. I mean, even when I was a kid with my friend Kate, we would like take my dad's old huge VHS camcorder and like make fake movies. And,
yeah, yeah.
you know, so it's not like it's something that's only, you know, 2012.
Right,
I think
right.
it's just an exciting...
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, when you're 30 or however old you are, you don't always give yourself the opportunity to kind of step back and just... try to make a project that uh-huh. you'll just throw up online because, yeah. you know, for a whole lot of reasons, there's a lot of impractical things about doing
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
So I felt like in that sense, that was really exciting to me.
Mm-hmm.
And there was something so exciting about doing a different form of artistic collaboration because I've been, you know, I've been in developing mm-hmm. plays and I've been in rooms with actors and rooms with directors and mm-hmm. having those kinds of conversations, but this was very different, you know.
Yeah.
Anybody who's been in both experiences will just talk about how different it is to be
yeah. Yeah.
actually trying to get the right take instead of trying to do whatever else happens in the rehearsal mm-hmm. room. So I think for me, I just appreciated it so much. I also, to be honest with you, I mean, maybe you've been in the same boat with, you know, when you're doing graduate coursework. I mean, I was towards the very end of my graduate coursework when
yes.
I was working on this.
Yes.
Or not coursework, my graduate career. I
right.
mean, I was finishing my dissertation
right.
as I was working on this. And there were some times where I thought, I shouldn't be doing this, you know? I should be focusing on what I need to focus on. Nobody that I send a CV
like
to.
Like what? CV, job market?
Yeah, yeah.
These kinds of
teaching,
things.
Yeah. I mean, I was at the time, I was teaching a script analysis course at Marymount.
I'm doing a podcast.
Exactly.
Right now,
you're doing a podcast.
And, yeah, and it's just from the same thing. I just
yeah.
felt I have a million things I should be doing right
exactly.
now. But I just had this impulse mm-hmm. to create something and put it out there.
I think sometimes you have to follow that.
Yeah.
I mean, I have plenty of ideas that I put down that, you know, thankfully I don't pursue.
Right.
But I think think.
I don't know. I was looking at your bio. It seems like you've pursued a lot. It seems like you've had a pretty dense little career there, Hillary.
I've been doing a lot. Yeah. I think that if there's one great thing about being in a grad program in theater, and I could imagine it's different in history or in another subject. Well, if you're in the right place or in the wrong place, depending. But there's a lot of practical involvement that you can keep up that's not considered just being a hobbyist.
Yeah, right.
But a web series, however, is pretty far outside of what I was going to be ready to put. For me, for my sort of own interest in producing and continuing to create and write things, it's relevant. But in terms of, you know, I was writing a dissertation about the New York fiscal crisis in 1974.
Your dissertation is about the Drop Dead era.
Yeah, it's theater.
70s in New York.
Yeah, it's
That's come up on the show many times.
In 74,
we
75
like the 70s,
New York.
And 80s in New York.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, I could have been doing any number of things connected to that and connected to my academic writing, which has actually grown in importance, in my life, as I'm sure everybody who's gone through this experience.
Yeah, it has to.
It must. Yeah. So I was teaching script analysis. Mm-hmm. I was working on my academic work.
Where did you teach script analysis?
I was teaching that at Marymount Manhattan.
Okay.
Which is uptown in the 70s. Uh-huh. And I felt almost at times like, you know, like I was like a guy with a second family or something.
Yes.
You know, like I'd be kind of like sneaking away to, you know, the editor would send a cut and I'd be trying to open up the you send it file on
because
the computer before teaching.
This isn't a grad school thing. This isn't official. This doesn't go
nowhere.
Does it go on the CV?
You know, I have, for my creative work, when I'm applying to theater jobs, I do have it listed.
Yeah.
But it's not the kind of thing that you know that's really gonna directly hit in applicability.
Right.
And it did feel, you know, I work plenty at the Institute, I teach, you know, it didn't fall into any category.
Right.
And
that's what makes it kind of refreshing, though.
Exactly.
Right? It's like a vacation from all that stuff.
In a way, it is. And you know what? It's an adrenaline boost.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because you don't really think that you have the time.
But you do.
And then you put this extra bit on, and it just kind of. It just kind of pushes you to think.
You stay really busy, though. You're one of those busy people, aren't you?
I am, but then, you know, there has to be a downtime. I mean, once we finished the first three, I became one of those people who just wants to be home at 6, making dinner, and, like, watching Downton Abbey.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
You know, I just need, like, a long phase of that after doing it. But ultimately, you know what? The job market's really tough right now for the kinds of fields that we're applying
in. Hey, you got to do what you want.
Yeah, and when
I
stepped back from what I had been doing, I thought, oh yeah, I was doing something that was, I think, pressing for so many reasons, you know, to me, that I am glad that I didn't, that tactical part of my mind didn't just say, okay, put it off until maybe summer 2015 when you know.
No, you had to do this. I mean, it's kind of like it's for you in a sense, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, in a sense that it's kind of like, I need something that's not the CV stuff. I need something that a part, but at the same time, it's like the impulse is always there. It's like the impulse to make something was always there. I think I always, in the back of my mind, want to do something other than teach or and I think part the job being on the job market is actually part of it that pushes you to this, right? Because I was like, I cannot depend on getting interviews and getting jobs as my identity. Like, as much as I want all that stuff and as much as I value all that stuff, I still feel like that I cannot depend one way or the other for my happiness on that. I need to do something that I really want to do. And and it sounds like American MD is part of you discovering that.
It is, because, I mean, it's part of academia where, you know, you feel guilty if you're even just, you know,
doing anything outside.
Yeah, I mean, you could want to take like a Latin class, or
watching
you could
an episode
take a
of Arrested
class.
Development.
Exactly.
You're like, wait a second, how is this going to fit into my dissertation?
That's how it's been.
I should not watch this. I should be reading an
article. That's
how it
is. It is so consuming. So I don't think
you never
get
any time
off.
It's a weird thing because it's like I think there's a perception outside of academia that academics have an incredible amount of time off, and they're basically you know, teach a couple hours a week and that's it. But there's an incredible like pressure that whenever you're awake, you should be doing something. Mm-hmm. And I never really understood that stress would be inescapable. Because I'm a pretty mellow person. I'm able to handle my stress pretty well, I think. But at the same time, graduate school really puts it on you.
It's
a journey. Mm-hmm. And a journey that, I don't know, makes you feel like you're right. If you do anything outside of it, you're not doing it right.
Sure, and so does teaching. You know,
you should be sending something else to a publisher right now.
Oh yeah, you should be sending out.
I don't even know why we're still sitting here talking. Why are we talking? I should probably be working on my book proposal.
I should be applying to a conference.
Yeah, exactly.
Or responding to a student.
Yeah.
Or
oh my God,
I mean,
I have
there's, you know, it's sort of endless. So
yeah, I was actually out to lunch with a friend who's also a professor the other day, and I checked my email on my phone while we were eating.
Big mistake.
Yeah, and he was like, what are you doing? And not from a, he wasn't mad like from a, like, you're rude because we're eating kind of thing. It was like, why would you do that? Because I was looking at student emails now, and it was appointments. It was like Schwartz Institute appointments. And I was like, well, I got to find out if I got to meet these people tomorrow, because otherwise I'm going to have to reschedule going to Whole Foods or whatever. And it's like such a thing. But either way, there's this sense that it's just always there.
Yes.
It's just always there. And I don't want to sit here and complain about how academics have it hard. But there is an element of like wanting something for yourself.
Well, yeah. Right? And I think it would be the same thing. I mean, look, if we were like high pressure attorneys, we would also be saying, can we figure out a way to take the cooking class that we want to take or something like this? So it's just a process of
why
of
people
balance.
Do yoga. Well, Hillary, we've gone a long time. Thanks so much. It's been a great conversation talking to you.
You can just like lop off the beginning.
Yeah.
And start where
That's what I usually do, but it was great talking to you.
Hey, thanks for interviewing me. This has been fun.
Sure, I'll talk to you soon.
Yeah.